Well, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to our afternoon session on the second day of Cool Logistics Global. I hope you all had time to take a break at lunch and get some food. And it was nice to see everyone in our virtual lunchroom and be able to enjoy some very pleasant and interesting conversations. So I'm only online here for a few minutes. We've got another great panel lined up. This is after the session moderated this morning by Oleshak. This is a second part of our review looking at the impact of the pandemic and the future view for global cold supply chain, reefer trade and perishable logistics. Ole is going to say a few words, obviously, to start, naturally, but, you know, we looked a lot at the shipping segment this morning, which is crucial, of course. Take a slightly broader view across the cold chain this afternoon. Yes, thank you again to all of our sponsors and speakers. Thank you to MSC and Port of Rotterdam for your support and participation this morning. Thank you to C-Cube and others participating this afternoon who've also supported us as sponsors. I'm really looking forward to this session, and thank you to Oleshak for taking another session on. And I'd like to turn over to you now, Ole, to begin the presentations.
Okay, thank you very much and welcome to everyone. I can see that the number of participants is rapidly increasing, so hopefully we will hit jackpot later this afternoon when we also have the US on board, as well as, for that matter, South America. As Rachel was mentioning, this morning we focused quite a lot on the shipping part of the effect of the pandemic. Today, or right now, we are going to go slightly deeper into the logistics and what happened and what is happening and some of the obstacles that we still see ahead of us, having the pandemic around us as us. From a Southern Hemisphere point of view, it's not a secret that 95% of the food transported on ocean is coming out of the Southern Hemisphere, be that Southern Africa, as well as South America, Australia, New Zealand, of course, and some of the, let's say, tropical countries in Southeast Asia. And it's all moving basically all moving to the Northern Hemisphere, and with a result that we rely obviously a lot on the local supply chains in the local countries. At one stage, back in February, March, and immediately after, I guess most of us one way or another participated in the food logistics in Berlin and got back home, and the world closed down on us. We did not really realize what was going to happen and to what extent it was going to impact. And at a certain point in time, I think we were all afraid that it was going to do much more harm and injury to us as an industry. But collectively, I think we worked our way out of it, but obviously at huge costs around the world and at different levels and degrees of complexity. And this is what I think we should focus on now, inviting first of all Andy Connell and later one of this to talk about the implications that it had on your geography as such. So with no further ado, Andy Connell, the word is yours.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much, Ulla. It's a pleasure being here today. We came back from Berlin, and suddenly our world did change, and I'm going to share with you our perspective of our reefer trade and our perishable logistics globally during this pandemic. Rachel, I don't have the screens, the share. Thank you very much. I do have it now. Well, us here in South Africa, we're accustomed to crisis. You know, we've had 20 years, 25 years of democracy, but our last 20 years, crisis has been very much part of our day. And so we're accustomed to dealing with it. But this pandemic certainly takes the cake. It certainly was a big disruptor and changed our lives immediately. So us silver-haired people had found that we were looking back to 1995 for a roadmap to take us through this crisis. And if I remind you what happened in 1995, South Africa had just emerged from many, many years of being the pariah of the rest of the world. We had come from years of sanctions. And the advent of our new president, Mr. Nelson Mandela, the late Mr. Nelson Mandela, propelled us into flavor of the month, which meant that our trade exploded, both import and especially export. But our ports weren't accustomed to this. Our logistics systems weren't accustomed to this. So they imploded. They literally collapsed in 95. And we had to find a way out of that very, very quick. We did cope. We did move on. And that's because we realized that to get out of this, we cannot stand and curse the people who aren't performing. We've got to work together. We've got to group together and work together. So we formed liaison forums in the big commercial centers around the country, and we worked together with the ports to get the new patterns established that would make the ports fluid. It involved a lot of collaboration and a lot of going back to the drawing board. And so this roadmap really helped us. Another thing that's really the same all around the world today. I don't think there's a country that can't say that a crisis they have doesn't get more complexity involved because of politics. Every crisis we have here gets very heavily involved in politics, which become roadblocks, which become bottlenecks, which become constrictions. And in our case, the reality is our nerves all around are simply too raw following the recent events of state capture, where all our state-owned entities have lost a lot of their top structure and a lot of their corporate memory through people losing their jobs through the corruption cases and the various inquiries that went on. So you find that individuals and groups are really sensitive to what they would consider either politically correct or acceptable or even offensive. And it goes beyond gender and it goes beyond race and ethnicity. So that acts as a compounding influence to make what we're about to go through in this pandemic even more of a challenge. The first thing that we noticed was that overnight, the ports went into an almost shutdown state. Whereas a port that was operating with seven gangs had to reduce down to one berth and one gang per shift, productivity went down. And because of that, lines cut their strings. And Bruce Marshall from Maersk spoke about that this morning, how lines found that they cut out slings because they just weren't making money. They just didn't have the volume on them. So our industry had to suddenly pivot. We had to turn around, we had to adapt. And that involved a lot of getting together. It wasn't just the fact that you had to first fight for your case that you were an essential service. And if you were an essential service, you had to register. And once you registered, then you got necessary permits to be able to operate. So operating remotely and working from home was the least of our problems. We're into Industry 4.0. Many organizations, especially the young people, adapted to this incredibly quickly. The people that really won were the fiber networks and the IT service providers. They went into almost instant overdrive and found that they were, from being somebody who supports a business, they were suddenly an essential service. And again, we heard about this morning the talk of the essential services that got our fruit moving around the world again, our food moving around the world again, and our productivity. So when we pivoted, we had to look at not just the shipping side of it, but on our farms, our workers. We had to protect our workers. If they weren't going to be fit to work, we weren't going to be able to harvest. So we had to educate them about what COVID-19 was. We had to move them. We had to get them from the migration, the migratory workers to the areas of harvesting and where they were going to stay and be able to move them around. So transport had to function, even if there were curfews, transactions still had to occur. Business had to carry on. So what industry did when we formed these forums and groups again is we started leveraging with the ports to also work non-essential cargo. We had to explain to them that, as Philip Gray was telling us this morning, a voyage just does not calculate if it doesn't generate a certain amount of cargo. If it falls below that threshold, the line will pull that vessel off the string and discontinue it. And we had our Middle East services, two lines, cancel their Middle East services for quite a while during this period. General cargo just had to be worked to allow that critical mass to develop to make the vessels worth coming in. And this meant we had a lot of imports gathering up in the ports. We had to manage the overstays outside the port. We had to leverage for getting parts of industry opened up so that the economy could reopen. And through all these online meetings, through all this collaboration online, people working remotely, we found a rhythm. We found that we could stop and breathe. We found we could slow down to a panic. And we got things done. But the reality is, looking back over those periods from March to June, every single container in itself was an event. You cannot say things went smoothly. It worked because people made it work, because people pushed product through the supply chain. The biggest casualty, apart from cruise ships, was air freight. Air freight really suffered, and freighter planes were carrying, even passenger planes were going full up with COVID-related protection material, medicines, safety gear, etc., PPE. So air freight really suffered. We couldn't move products from markets to us. And collateral damage then also became all our imported agricultural inputs, our fertilizers, our chemicals got paralyzed. We had to really fight to get those to move back into the port. The least of the problems were the lockdowns. The biggest problems was that staff that had to move were being stopped by authorities on roads because they were moving outside of a curfew area or they were moving at all. So it looked at some stage like it wasn't going to work at all and that we would find ourselves in a state of paralysis, and farmers were seriously worrying. But we're resilient people and we developed new strategies. We moved faster into the digital transformation world in 3 months than we did in the previous 3 years. In the last 6 months, than the last 6 years, we really catapulted forward where a lot of documentation that was paper-based became electronic with backups, and we could then do digital certification a lot quicker. The agricultural industry has a very nice organization called the Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy, and they immediately set up a series of response teams in all the industries. And these response teams provided hotlines for the problem-solving teams. So if you had a problem getting workers from A to B, you would call this line. This would be channeled very swiftly up to government levels. And then the proactive management backwards down to the authorities. You have to let these people move. You have to let open these gates. You have to let this move. You have to let this happen. You have to open your offices and process certification. So through this process that the Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy created, we could then start moving things through the pipeline and remove the roadblocks one by one to allow trade to come through. Over the last 10 years, we've really been improving our producers' relationships with our departments of agriculture. And our Department of Agriculture and our inspection bodies really stepped up to the plate. We had a fantastic response. It was quite exciting to be in this time because of the way people collaborated and worked together. At the same time as moving the product, we also were keenly aware that there were people growing more and more desperate because they weren't allowed out on the streets in lockdown. Those poor people that normally begged, the subsistence people, the people that relied on community help. And we found our farmers opened their arms and provided product. They provided mangoes, they provided palm fruit, the last of the grapes. They went and said, we've got product. And now how do you distribute it? And we found that if we channeled it through organizations that had credibility, that we knew the food would go in the right direction, because it's not just a matter of presenting food to poor people. You also have to protect the wet markets and the hawkers. You cannot take their ability to earn away totally. We found our channel through an organization that started in 2009 called Food Forward South Africa. They're fantastic at reverse logistics. They were normally taking food from supermarkets that were starting to run to expiry, bringing it back in, reprocessing it, and then putting it back on the markets at a lower end and in aid agencies. So Food Forward South Africa stepped in and partnered with our whole fruit industry and became the distribution arm, the distribution network of all this goodwill that was coming out from our farming communities, our producers and our exporters. And we were able to contribute hugely, very significantly. It made good news headlines, but it was real work done to help the indigent, to help the desperate people, actually with meals and with foods. And of course, coming into citrus season, then you had vitamin C, which was so important. And one thing about fruit is you can package it in such a way that an orange is that person's meal for the morning and an orange is for the afternoon, not like a loaf of bread that has to be sliced up a million ways and can't be distributed. You could then give an orange per head or an avo per two people and so on. So we found that we could channel food where it had to go best. And slowly we got our ports a bit more fluid and we got our production processes back in gear. We had our people safe and we could actually produce and process food and sell food overseas. We had lots of problems with our cross-border trade, which still exists today, but we did a lot of alleviating to get food coming from Africa that had to go out for export through the borders. And that was a tiresome work in progress. So we actually got going. Now we look back and what we want to know in this conference is, what did we actually learn and what do we do to carry forward in case there's another second wave? We know where we've come from and we know we survived, but what did we actually learn from this? Were there good lessons out of this? And yes, there most certainly were. We learned that we did get food and farmer products out and we got essentials in. And if you look at the figures, we got all the fruit to be exported out that should have been exported and the food out and in that should have gone out and come in. But realistically, let's be honest. If you talk to the shipping lines, if you talk to the market that received the product, they will tell you it didn't come smoothly. It came in fits and starts. We had vessels sit on our coast for 12 days, 14 days. We had some product take 60 days just inside the country to get out the border. Yes, we got it out, but it wasn't without quite a bit of damage that went with it. And luckily the world was in the same boat, so we cannot say there was a lot of reputational damage. Did we fail ourselves? Yes, we did. We were working in silos. The different categories worked in silos. And my consultancy takes me across many categories, working with blueberries, working with grapes, working with stone fruit and palm fruit and citrus fruit. I would sit in on various meetings that we had going to smoothen the playing field, to grease the wheels, to oil the cogs, to help product to flow. And one thing really struck me was that each category was working in its own silo, reinventing the same wheel that someone else was reinventing. And that was a mistake. We should have gotten all fruit kinds into one basket from day one. And when we had our meetings with the ports and when we had our meetings with the authorities, spoken as one fruit kind, as fruit, not each category on its own. So going forward, what have we learned from that? Well, we've learned that we've got a lot of resilience, and we've learned that we now have to develop tools to replicate what the citrus grower body of Southern Africa did to mitigate the risk, to distribute foods, to cope with the problems, to engage with the authorities, to suppress people who were talking about the big problems and throwing bricks and stones at shipping lines and ports and transporters and say, that's not productive. Let's work together on this. It's a problem, so let's work together. Don't come and moan about the problem unless you're part of the solution. And so we will roll that out in future to all fruit kinds and cope a lot better. Thank you, Ulla.
Thank you very much, and look forward to receive comments and questions to you during the next part of the session. Moving on immediately to you, Juan Andres, joining us from Chile. Be aware, all of you, that Juan Andres has an issue with his camera, so you will not be able to see him, but you should be able to listen to him. So over to you, Juan Andres, por favor.
Juan, do we have you? Juan, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Unfortunately, I cannot. Something is not working correctly with the camera. So
so you go on with your presentation, one of us.
Okay. All right. Well, today we everybody shares there is a level of uncertainty that is very abnormal, and of course we cannot escape from reality. Reality is basically something that will join us for at least best scenarios, they say, if all the vaccines works 6 months, maybe a year, of something completely unexpected. From the shipper standpoint, there are five realities that the farmers, the growers, the exporters are dealing today, not only in Chile or Argentina, Peru, or South Africa, New Zealand, or Australia, which are the powerhouses on the perishable logistics side in the Southern Hemisphere. Their operations are highly disturbed right now. There is an existing operation today, which is pretty simple. Everybody knows that this, when the farmer sells their goods at their door, and the dart at the ranch door, it's very simple. The other is when the farmer or the grower ships their product into a broker or intermediaries distribution center. The third reality is when the customer, when the grower and or the farmer goes a step further and starts shipping product into the customer distribution center. passing the, I mean, taking a cut from the intermediaries. Then the next level is highly disturbed right now, is when the shipper or the grower starts sending fruit to a retailer or a food service distribution center or store. And then because of the online awareness or the online business development, there is especially local, there is a lot of an increase on the farm to fork or farm to table. Where are we going now? It's hard to say, because it's every reality has its challenges, but the farm to door is going away. The grower needs a better income, and this way of business is disappearing very rapidly. There is always a very negative side on this reality, because the end consumer will never know really full traceability of the fruit or the vegetables or the salmon or the meat, because the product was sold at the farm door. And of course that is also there is also a reality that the retailer or the food service or distributor wants to increase their margins, so wants to go to source and buy the fruit or the product at the farm store. So it's always two waves colliding. Like I said, this way of business is at least in the neighborhood here in South America is disappearing faster. Will much depend on grower finances if he continues or not, because every time there is more people are asking responsibilities from the shippers or the growers in terms of traceability and food safety. Now there is the other reality, which you will know when the farmer send the fruit to a broker or a exporter or a intermediary. It's important to know that that situation, that reality is the majority of the operations right now. Gives the grower a secure, gives the consumer more security, or gives the intermediary and the customer of the intermediary a lot more security in food safety. The intermediary can adapt the package to the consumer and provides a good timing for deliveries. That is also a moving reality. What everybody's concentrating right now, what we see here, especially in Chile, is when the farmer or the grower starts sending product directly to a food service or retail or distribution center. It's pretty much the same way what's happening with the farms to farm store, when the retailer food service companies are trying to increase their margins. They're very keen to go and try to establish this kind of relationship that basically will enhance the quality assurance of the fruit. Of course, for the customer, this type of reality will give a better control into the inventory. The big problem, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, is about what happened with the product or the fruit or the vegetable is not suitable or is not in grade with the customer requirements. And of course, one thing we touched in the Berlin convention was the on-time deliveries, because then the grower or the shipper is fully responsible for that. In the last and fifth reality, which was mentioned before, is when the grower is shipping their product into a final end consumer, take advantage today of the online because of supermarkets or stores closed because of the pandemia. Now, it's always a big challenge here to the farmer, because the farmer, because of the logistics considerations, he needs to be absolutely sure that all their labors and operational labors, cultural labels and operational labors, they need to be sure about harvest, when, the packing, if it's okay, the infrastructure is correct, the planning is okay, the finance is okay. Needs to have more than ever a very credible and certified quality assurance system. Now you see growers now taking all the step for to implement refrigerated facilities at the farms because they need that. The challenges on the intermediary now is to secure the transportation from the farm, their planning and financing for their operation. They need to be aware of what products need to be reconditioned before shipping to the customers. They need to have the quality assurance system. New certifications are coming, new regulations, domestic and international, because of the pandemic. Now, the intermediary now is more aware than ever all the risk on the transportation, domestic and international. There's a huge debate here in Chile about transportation and who pays for the freight bill, customer or the shipper, because of the risk involved. Because now, more than ever, countries can adopt some new regulation that might mean that the containers or the trucks or the shipments are stopped because of food safety, food health, or health problems. So it's the intermediary is facing a lot of problems. The distribution center, either retailer or food service, is probably today facing a very high pressure because of these uncertainties. Been talking to good colleagues in the United States that works in retail operation distribution centers, and they're very high pressure because of the transportation issues, because uncertainties. That's probably the word that everybody is speaking today, uncertainty. How to operate when you don't know if your product is gonna come. And your orders from the stores or from the customers will suffer. It's a very, very, very critical situation today. We face today, we are trying to with a farmed salmon supplier from Chile, trying to set up the program for a man in Jordan, and by air. And today it's impossible because there is no secure logistic buyer. I mean, all depends in passenger flights. The cargo planes will charge what is the cost today of shipping a product, and today is probably triple what it used to be. So there you go. I mean, a customer that needs some product is willing to pay the price, FOB, origin, but it's the CNF price is completely out of reach because of the uncertainty of flight passengers. cargo planes will now be dedicated to fly vaccines everywhere in the world. So that's, I don't know, 8,000 to 10,000 flights that will go away from transportation, regular transportation, and will mean that the shipper and the grower and the customer will face a higher air rate. We hope that everything is gonna come back to on a normal, because what we don't know what normal is right now, but it's something that is important to face, and not to bring too much negativity, but there is an immediate need of product that will need to go by plane, but it's out of reach because of the cost of the freight on the available freight by air, and you don't know if it's gonna fly or not. So it's something that is ongoing. We in Chile were facing very unstable times because of the bailout next few days, but the government at least set up very clear rules in terms of transportation and activities, which give us at least a good platform to work on. But again, airplanes, uncertainty, complete uncertainty. Ocean shipments, that provides secure operation today, but South America is 20 to 25 days from everywhere in the world. I mean, main European ports, main US ports, main Asian ports in Japan, Korea, or China, and Southeast Asia, 40 days away from Middle East or India. So you will see a gap in supplies this coming fruit season, from November to December, where probably there's not gonna be any product, or if there's gonna be product, it's gonna be very highly priced. So right now we expect to have a fairly clear, forecast on what are the market in, or what are the rules or government rules in the markets where the fruit is going to come, because that will dictate the use of transportation. There is being some prohibitions, some shipments standby because of health situation in Southeast Asia for some from blueberries. Now there are always some development that creates uncertainty, and this only will be solved if the I call it supply chain members will collaborate. Right now is we all know the world is getting very small. It takes, you're 3 days away from anywhere in the world right now, and the farmer will collaborate in their aspect, the packer, the trucking, the airlines, railroads, the ocean shipping guys, the wholesaler, distributors, the imports, the freight forwarders have a big role here, huge role, coordinating everything, the custom brokers, the cold storage and repacking operations, the retailers and food service, all the supply chain needs to collaborate today. That's a big word today, big word, because we will face a lot of uncertainties in the next 6 to 10 months, maybe a year, with the movement of our products, perishable products, from origin to destination. It's important. The grower will give their knowledge on the product. Total shelf life. What is the best product to ship? He has post-harvest knowledge. All the experts in transportation, refrigerated transportation, will play a big role, because today, as ever, we need to extend shelf life as much as possible, because anything can happen. Need to be a better collaboration with statistics, numbers, supply and demand information. Food safety and produce traceability will play a big part here. Big part. Now, because of these transportation issues, like we said on the planes, I mean, everybody's exploring multimodal scenarios, shipping by truck from Chile to Brazil or to Paraguay or even to Peru, to get a better rate, or at least space to ship. We need to be more upfront on our cost and our profits. Sometimes nobody wants to talk about it, but we need to talk about it, because there is no charity here. There is no Salvation Army here. The product that's given away has a cost, and we need to reduce waste. It's important to know that everybody needs to make money. The farmer needs to make money, so keep growing. The transportation companies, all of them, needs to make money to keep hauling the product. The wholesaler distributor need to make money to keep selling. Retailers and the food service companies, they need to make money to grow their operations. If somebody there doesn't make what he needs to keep their operation alive, I mean, the supply will be disrupted. There's no way, it's not gonna happen. So uncertainty is only workable with collaboration. Changes are only workable if people collaborate and have an open conversation about the problems. The supply chain disruptions will only be solved and workable with collaboration. Food safety information management will be critical, and everybody needs to be aware of it. And to combine everything, I mean, if we're gonna have a profitable supply chain, everybody needs to collaborate. Today the reality is leading us to talk to all supply chain members. It's incredible how much more information we get from shipping lines, from freight forwarders to custom brokers, even our customers in China, in Japan, in Europe, and United States, because everybody's aware of this uncertainty. And because nobody can work with uncertainty. It needs to be something there. It needs to be information to provide. It needs to be somehow credible information. But everybody are facing their challenges. Everybody has a reality, everybody has their challenges. And of course, those things will work only with collaboration. As we all know, we all are working to deliver the cheapest price possible to increase demand of our products and assure the growers a good return, because it needs to keep growing. Same as the camera today. I mean, sometimes things don't work the way we want. And I think the only way is going to be through collaboration. I mean, it was meant to, this presentation was meant to be just to present the reality, the challenges, and how we're gonna work, because probably it's not gonna be solved.
Thank you very much, Juan Andres, and I will collaborate now by thanking you for an insightful presentation that is obviously valid. This not having COVID-19 on us, but it just goes to prove that all these issues that we are seeing now have of course been very much enlarged and made even bigger issues and more urgent issues to have solved when we hit a crisis like the one we are going through right now as a world. So thank you very much for that. I'm sure there will be some further comments and questions on that. So without further ado, we will be moving on to C-Cube, one of the big supporters of Cool Logistics. And the word is yours, Greg Sutton.
Yeah, thank you, Ollie. I appreciate that lead-in that Juan provided. For all those in the audience, good afternoon. Good morning and good evening. What I'd like to do is give everyone just a overview of what we experienced during COVID, and then what we experienced post lockdown, and then give you some insight as to the outlook of where we're headed. So anyway, with that being said, let me move on here. So here's a few things I'd like to share with you, and certainly I think it'd be beneficial to open it up to discussion during the panel discussion when we follow the slide presentations. So just real quick, I think I'm not alone when I say that we were all a little bit concerned about the onset of COVID-19 and what we experienced, and some of the uncertainty that we've talked about already, but during the lockdown period, and that came very quickly following what we learned from China in early January, February, and then through March, what we experienced here in the U.S. and common in some of the other regions in the globe, and that is we saw this quick run on foods, typically at the distribution level and at the grocery store level. So here's a quick picture of what we experienced here, but I'm sure that's not uncommon. So what did, well, I think a lot of people were concerned about what the outcome was going to be. Therefore, they were basically hoarding food, which put a lot of stress and strain on the supply chains, including the refrigerated supply chains and the cold chain networks as well. So that created some unevenness in the resurgence of replenishment, number one. Number two, it created a lot of disruption in the cold chain in itself. So moving on to number two, what happened following that first phase of the lockdown period? Well, when things started to open up, we experienced, and this is all from a container leasing perspective and a container supply perspective in terms of what we have experienced, but following that lockdown period, and as the market started to reopen, there was this tremendous pressure on trying to recover, and that was based on the report of the supply chain relative to the cold chain. So that created some disruption at the ports, that created some disruption in the transportation delivery and the conveyance of cold chain products. And then the other big piece of this that was experienced in terms of just flows, equipment flow perspective, but in terms of product flows, was labor sourcing. So labor sourcing was certainly a concern, because as people contracted the COVID-19 and were infected, certainly labor shortages started to occur. So you know, this started with foods and certainly some depletion of food stocks, and then it certainly quickly went into a supply chain disruption type of scenario. So, you know, if you go back and look at where we were in the early part of the year, up through March, I think there was concern about where we were headed and where the markets would go ahead and unfold. And a lot of comments were made about the supply chain relative to refrigerated products, both frozen and fresh foods. And is the cold chain markets, and specifically to our business on the refrigerated sectors, basically the pandemic came, but the refrigerated markets were rather resilient to what we experienced, and because irrespective of the pandemic and the economic downturns that we've all experienced, food still needs to move. There's replenishment cycles that still need to occur. And while there were less replenishment chains that took place at the restaurant level, people were still at home eating, and certainly some of the categories shifted in terms of where the demand was. But nonetheless, we as a leasing company, from a supply standpoint on the equipment access points, the demand was still very, very high. In fact, in some cases, COVID created more demand because of some of the sourcing and the replenishment as we saw some of the resurgence in volume. So looking into this, you know, what we really experienced during the pandemic created actually, I think, for those who are involved in the business, to go ahead and not only provide access to equipment, but to go ahead and offer relief and to go ahead and try to look at recovery efforts in terms of trying to go ahead and continue to move product despite some of the disruption on the supply chain. So some of the regions, in fact, mentioned before, saw an acceleration of refrigerated movement, and that's primarily due to the replenishment cycles that we experienced. So, you know, again, I'll go back into the whys and the causes of why the refrigerated market's a little bit more resilient to the pandemic or even the economic downturns than some of the other categories within the shipping sector. One is, you know, the population growth continues to go ahead and accelerate. Urbanization pressure continues to demand more food sourcing from different regions. And there's a number of other reasons that are tied into the resilience of the market. But there's that last one bullet point that's also going to be a big factor going forward, and that is the need for transport of pharmaceutical goods, more specifically vaccines that will go ahead and assist with the vaccinations. So that's going to certainly first be moved through air freight, and then followed by a replenishment or backfill by ocean freight. So therefore, there will be high growth, high demand for vaccine transport in the ocean mode. So moving ahead, just real quickly, I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail, but what we may see, and this is probably going to happen through 2021, is there's going to continue to be a high growth rate. And I think probably during the session in part one, this was probably to some extent, there's going to be a high growth rate or continue to be a stability factor in the refrigerated movement area in transportation. And that growth rate, you know, this is just a forecast, but that growth rate could be anywhere between 4 and 6% going forward, irrespective of how we recover from the pandemic. On the bottom graph there, the one thing that's important to note is there's been supply shortages relative to equipment availability for a couple reasons. One, during COVID, we saw shutdowns on container manufacturing. We also disruption, which I mentioned earlier, and we also saw just the access to equipment being disrupted because of the imbalance in equipment flows. So, you know, with all this being said, with the fundamentals of the refrigerated trade being more resilient, now going forward in terms of how we recover, we have to make sure we look at how we access equipment, how we supply equipment, and how we make sure refrigerated movements are maintained as we go through the next few months. So if you look at just total global container port throughput, we see an increase going forward. And part of that is gonna be tied to refrigerated movements and cold chain supply. But again, one thing that we are looking at is if there is a second wave of lockdowns, we could see a repeat of what we experienced in the early part of the year, which is disruption on the supply chain and also some access issues relative to refrigerated assets, but also just the movement of cold chain products. If you look forward, and this is a forecast all the way through 2024, we do see the refrigerated sector being much more stable. And again, it ties back into the theme of it being more resilient to some of the pandemic challenges that we're all facing. So we'll see how this unfolds. But I think as we continue to go ahead and look at the cold chain market, we see additional sourcing from different regions, and that will continue to probably be the trend. If you look at some of the catalysts that drive the refrigerated markets, and this is both within a pandemic situation and even outside a pandemic situation, I've listed five catalysts that drive refrigerated growth, irrespective of economic conditions. One, as I already mentioned, population growth. Number two, the nutrition and healthier diets. That's a factor that's continuing to gain popularity. Some of you may have heard about the plant-based diet trend, which seems to be, again, growing. That is driving, again, more refrigerated product, more chilled product, and more frozen product through our cold chain networks. Sustainable seafood sourcing is also something that's high on the priority list, I think, for most nations, if not all. That continues to drive more sourcing within that sector of that food group. Proteins, I think, was mentioned probably earlier. Proteins certainly continue to be a high growth commodity within the refrigerated markets, and probably will continue to be. And then number four, I've already mentioned this, this requirement and also the high growth expectation for the demand for pharma transport with temperature controlled environments. And again, more specifically, there's gonna be an urgency to transport the vaccines once they are released. Again, admittedly, they'll be probably moved in the air freight mode prior to ocean freight, but nonetheless, there's been a lot of development with ocean freight specifics and requirements relative to machinery type and assets that will be certainly built for vaccination or vaccine for vaccination implementation. Moving on to just where we are relative to a supply outlook, and this is really just specific to the reefer container supply outlook, tied and oriented to the leasing business, which is our business. We are trying to go ahead and prepare for 2021 based on recent equipment shortages and the one concern, which is container supply. And again, a lot of the container supply shortages have been related to the lockdowns, but then again, just supply shortages relative to capacity constraints. So going forward, we do see this continuing most likely through 2021 for some time, because we don't think supply will catch up for that particular year. However, what we are doing is, again, that we're providing access to equipment, assisting in the recovery efforts to make sure that product continues to move and to make sure there's less disruption on the cold chain sector. We are trying to look forward in terms of making sure that we are securing line time, number one, securing capacity, number two, and also from a forward-looking investment perspective, we're trying to go ahead and buy forward to make sure we have supply during at least first and second quarter of 2021. But again, I think if there's anything that keeps us up at night and a concern we have, it would be making sure there's adequate supply in the refrigerated arena for movement of cold chain supply products. Again, I'm not gonna go through the detail of this outlook. This again is just a forecast, and it's based on trend analysis. But again, I think if there's anything that we are focused on in terms of being proactive, it's to try to buy forward and try to look at securing capacity as early as we can to make sure we're well prepared for 2021. In conclusion, again, and I'm not gonna go through all these bullet points in detail, but we still think that the refrigerated shipping market will continue to grow. Therefore, we think it's gonna be more resilient to any of the economic downturns that we're experiencing as a result of the pandemic. We think there's going to be ongoing demand for temperature control container products, which is again tied to the cold chain. Pharmaceutical demand will pull some capacity away from traditional products that typically move in refrigerated containers. I think we're going to have to go ahead and look at that capacity balance so we ensure that we too much capacity over to one sector versus another. And then again, I think, you know, I've mentioned this before in the presentation, this shift to healthier diets and fresh foods, I think will continue to be a phenomena that we all experience as across the globe we're looking at that particular area to be healthier and to make sure they're maintaining a healthier diet. So I think that's gonna, again, drive some growth going forward. That's all I have, Ole. If there's any questions, I'm sure we can take the questions during the panel discussion.
Yes, thank you very much, Greg. Very good presentation, thank you. And I'm sure we'll be coming back to some of those issues a little later on in the afternoon or the morning at your place. Ruben, first of all, you're going to present us something about Morocco. And Morocco is somehow, for me, close to my soul, my reefer soul, because it was the first market I tried to break into when there was a monopoly there. It's also, in my mind today, one of the supply markets that stands to win in what actually Greg is also referring to and Thomas were doing earlier in the morning, when talking about people eating healthier, because it's kind of a supply market that is like near sourcing to very close to a huge consumer market being the EU and Europe in general, of course, including for that matter Russia, which is a big buyer of Moroccan produce. I will not go into it more than that for now, but I hope that people will start thinking about what I mentioned and what you're going to talk about so we can have a debate and some interesting questions coming along when you are finished. So over to you, Ruben. The floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Ole, and thanks to my four speakers. It's really exciting debates today and exciting presentations. There were already some mentioning my favorite word, the collaboration, and that's what I'm actually going to talk about today. We have normally when I'm at Cool Logistics, I talk about telematics and on the technology side, but to be honest, I have a bit enough of that at the moment. We spend a lot of time in front of our screens. So I would like to talk about something else today, about collaborating with friends in order to build a new venture in a time of crisis. So in this time of uncertainty, doing something new and learning about an exciting, growing cool chain logistics market, in this case, Morocco. So let's get into this. I am running a network of global sea freight expert firms, mainly logistics companies and NVOCCs. With currently around 124 members in 76 countries, a growing number of which are in the cool chain logistics specialization. We pride ourselves by doing a bit more than just bilateral facilitation between these parties. We actually really try to work more like a think tank to bring people together and to solve problems that all of them have. And we look at a lot of these common challenges that they are facing. One of which is internationalization. We always try to identify the best partners in every market. However, sometimes this partner does not exist. In Morocco, this was the case, and many opportunities for members with Morocco were not really realized because they were lacking a partner that they trusted. I think in our business, trust is still a very important thing. And so, as we sometimes say, if the right partner doesn't exist, you have to build it. And so the idea was to bring some people together and to build that organization, that partner that we would like to have. And this was the birth of Navirock. We brought together several investors, several members of the network that wanted to build something there. And together with a local partner that has the know-how and that secured the talent for us. And this has started. This Naviroc is a logistics platform in Morocco. It's acting as a local office for investors, but also for all members of the network, while providing solutions to local customers. The company is fully operational since end of August and had a great start so far and is already growing into quite some business. Building Naviroc, it also meant for us to dive very deep into the Moroccan cold chain market, which is highly interesting. It's number three for foreign direct investment on the African continent. It's the number two of Chinese investment in Africa. It has an increasingly important player on the European fruit and vegetable market. I would like to provide you a bit of an overview today based on a few products that are coming from Morocco. We are starting with Morocco in general. It was always an agricultural country. For example, growing citrus since the 7th century, or wine since more than 2,500 years, some of which tastes very nice. I can talk from own experience here. And it really got a boost in 2008 when the Moroccan government was putting out the Green Morocco Plan, where they had a real focus on agricultural modernization, investing in targeted programs and setting clear goals, which resulted in significant growth. Even so, not all was achieved as they planned. The country made a huge step forward with this program. In the 2018-2019 season, 3.1 million tons of produce were actually exported, $6 billion in revenue created, which is almost a doubling since 2010. It's 30% of the export earnings of the country. It's 20% of the country's GDP. It's 40% of the population that is employed in the agri sector today, and 80% of the rural workforce. Pushing it further for the next 10 years is the Generation Green project, which will make it even more an example for entire Africa. Vegetables, the significance for the European market has grown, where it has become really a competitor to Spain on some commodities, where it's growing its market share consistently every year, and where it's especially in terms of tomatoes, watermelons and oranges really playing an increasing force, especially now in the pandemic. Vegetables are a key export commodity, and king among them from the Moroccan perspective are tomatoes. There will be a lot of numbers in the slides that come after. If anyone has a numbers fetish, just get the slides later, read through them in detail. I will not go into every number of them, so they are there for those people that want to dig in, and I'm really here to give you an overview a bit today. So Morocco is now ranked fourth in tomato exports, after Mexico, which is of course mainly producing for the US, the Netherlands and Spain, so competing mainly in the European market. A key challenge there is certainly logistics costs, which sometimes are up to triple those of Spain, and I'm coming to that also a bit later in more detail. Apart from tomatoes, we have green beans and peppers forming the top three together. Peppers in the meantime have actually reached sixth place in global exports of peppers. So Morocco also has been climbing up on that commodity. Fruits are dominated by citrus, where the production has reached 2.5 million tons now, and thus is one of the key commodities being key perishables being exported from the country, 30% of which of this production is being exported, and they continue to grow significantly. There was a bit of dent in the last year's season because of a very hot August, which harmed a lot of the mandarins production. And in 2020, I'm just back from Morocco 2 weeks ago, things are improving a lot, and we are likely back to the 2018 highs. Not fully there, but on the way. There are about 13,000 producers of citrus in Morocco that harvest from October to May, so after the South African season ends more or less, and then different varieties over a period of time. 32% in this is coming from the Suez-Marsa region. We have also here top three, which is clementines, mandarin kind, Maroc late, and novel oranges. And maybe to give you a bit of a view is, in terms of oranges, it's still relatively small. The global export market share of Morocco is still below 2%. If you compare that with Spain, which is at 26.5, there's still a lot of room for growth where Morocco can actually grow their part. Next up is berries. And that's a bit special because berries somehow started this whole project for us. There was, during COVID, suddenly blueberries from Morocco in the supermarkets in Switzerland, something we didn't have before, and they were delicious. And of course, being involved with Cool Logistics since a while, I start looking at everything that enters our fridge. Where does it come from? What country is involved? And somehow it led to reaching out to a friend who moved back to Morocco, and it started the whole story, which somehow evolved from that. Berries are another growth story also. In the meantime, it's 140,000 tons of production, which with the Green Maroc plan shall move up to 200,000 tons until 2023. Dominating, of course, strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, still actually a smaller share. As two-thirds of the production is exported, a small part fresh, a larger part frozen. And of course, the last fruit that we want to look at are watermelons, the favorite of my wife. So if I omit that, I would be in serious trouble. Watermelons have grown to about 163 million kilos. In Morocco, they grow the longer, bigger version of the watermelons, not the small round ones and the great variety that you might be known from Spain. But one of the good things was also that apart from the growth in volume, they have been able last year to achieve a higher market price in the European market than Spanish watermelons have achieved. So we are in shipping. That's why we're going to talk a bit about shipping as well. And perishable logistics, how does all this move? Being close to its key market, Europe, but also serving the United Kingdom, Russia, Middle East, the US, and parts of Asia, Morocco is using all transport modes, from refrigerated trucks to conventional reefer ships for the US and citrus movements, to ro-ro services in the Mediterranean, to reefer containers, to air freight for what's the Middle East. Everything is more or less used to get produce to where it needs to go. In terms of cold storage, there is an interesting Dutch study. I'm in Rotterdam anyway, so referring to Dutch might be the best one to use. Morocco is actually seeing some kind of an underinvestment in cold storage if it's compared to others. There has something happened since 2018. There is Spanish Romeo Group has invested, French Sofrilog has invested, but there is certainly potential for more cold storage in Morocco. We have, of course, have several members in the network that have an expertise in the sector, be it Van der Helm in Holland or be it Sankyo Corporation in Japan. And we are also seeing the task for our venture there to check for opportunities in that sector. So it's certainly a space to watch also for us. A challenge in Morocco is no doubt logistics cost. As I mentioned earlier, there is a certain difference compared to Spain and to other competitors that grow inside the European Union. Of course, on the other hand, we all know the citrus market and others are facing a really drop in prices. So you have logistics cost versus price, which is a challenge that we are all facing and where it's about finding solutions. I would like to close with just a few questions that we and the team in Morocco is facing from customers, and that also have been repetitive questions all for our industry, whether it is with COVID or without COVID. How can we get to farther away markets while maintaining quality? What can we learn from what South Africa is doing, what the people in South America are doing, as an example, to reach Asia, to reach China markets? How can we narrow the cost in terms of logistics? Another opportunity, because we had that earlier, the problem that in South America at the moment, there is no flight capacity. that gives the opportunity for blueberries from Morocco. So there is a certain kind of the one's loss is the other person's win. And same thing with Brexit. If there is suddenly a situation where Spain has the same level playing field as Morocco towards the UK, there come new opportunities. So there is quite something happening as well. On the other hand, of course, sustainable, environmentally friendly transport. Ole mentioned it quickly, nearshoring. There is, of course, agricultural area very close to Europe where we can get things from with a much better CO2 balance than from other markets. And then, of course, the last questions, which I still consider one of the key questions for our industry and for fruits and vegetables in general, how can we decommoditize the product? What our friends from Be Frank Bananas were explaining yesterday, and what also for other products matters, how can we actually give the fruit a face that we can charge a higher price? And these kind of questions are the same. And we're looking forward to discussing some of them today, of course. Yeah, other than that, thank you very much. We made a deeper study on the market. You can download that on the website. If you have any needs in Morocco, the team will be more than happy to help. And it was a pleasure to be there and looking forward to an exciting discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent presentation. And for those that are you that wonder what this presentation is doing and the COVID-19 effect, let me just repeat that Morocco, from our point of view, is one of the biggest possibilities and opportunities for near sourcing from a European perspective, thereby reducing the risk of supply chain if we continue going ahead with obstacles from the Southern Hemisphere. And I'm sure that also with the more healthy diets, Morocco is going to be on the forefront in terms of supplying, especially, of course, into Europe. On that note, I will go on. We are planning on ending in 25 minutes. I know that some people thought it was ending 5 minutes ago, but it isn't. It is going on till at least 5:15 CET or 4:15 UK time. I'll move on to some of the questions that we had in, and I hope that we can have Juan Andres on here because there's a question from Hessel from Triton. You mentioned about uncertainties on the receiver end if they will get their goods. Do you foresee an increase in cold store capacity overall, or rather maybe a need for cold store capacity going forward at destinations? And that question I direct to you, Juan Andres, if you're still there. Annelise, can you see if Juan Andres is on?
I'm just looking. It looks like he is, but I'm not sure that he can hear us. I'm sorry, Ole.
Then from where I work,
hang on.
Okay.
Juan, yep. Are you there?
You can see him coming on now.
Juan, okay. Are you there?
Juan. No, I think you should mute him. Yeah. Let me just answer partly that question, because we, as Brutal Justice, we are in the business of cold stores and in Europe, and we see absolutely an increased need for cold stores and distribution centers in Europe, handling an increase in volume, and particularly around the big centers like Rotterdam, Antwerp, to a certain extent also Le Havre. And then we'll have to wait and see what happens with the UK and Brexit, but I'm sure that the UK will have to build some more receiving capacity later on, because it won't pass by Europe and be held on the continent any longer. Moving on to Alex, he has a couple of questions. This is for you, Greg. Why is there such a difference between Gruus and CQ's reefer projection for 2024? I am not sure that there is that, but if he says so, he must have picked up.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what slide he's referring to. Of course, there's always a difference in projections based on what we're seeing as trend analysis and what we're seeing from juries. So we use historical data from our own database in terms of how we see the market growing, and then we also reference juries for some of the data as well. So there's always going to be a difference. We are still very bullish on the reefer market. In fact, we see probably some conversion growth coming from the conventional reefer side of the business back into containerized movement. So we think there's going to be probably some accelerated growth on top of just organic growth. So some of that is attributed to that factor as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good point. Moving on to John Trinset, question from him. With the consumers now looking for healthy and possibly sustainable food, and is the sustainability agenda going to drive behavior and reefer supply chains moving forward? I would like Ruben to comment on that, and maybe also get Andy Cornell in on the panel again.
I think it will for sure become much more important. I don't know, everybody can see that in their own household now. There is more cooking at home, there is more eating together, there is less going out, so there is much more conversation about food. What do we buy? Everybody does their grocery shopping again. There is more talk. Here in Switzerland, you see a lot of people actually doing a lot of more home gardening, growing even some own produce to some way. I think there is much more conversation about food and where does it come from compared to the past. I don't know what the others are feeling there.
Sure. And Andy, any insights on that from your side, and what are the South Africans expecting?
Ole and team, yes, certainly sustainability is very much on the question, and part of the sustainability is the sustainability of the production units themselves. So there are quite a few audits that have to be done on farms, and to make sure that the farming practices are the best practices, are good agricultural practices. And sustainability has for quite a while been quite a topic. So it's the use of the land and the reuse of the land and the preservation of the land that is quite on topical as far as sustainability is going, as well as the people who are doing the actual farming. Are the practices using renewable energies? Are we reusing? Are we recycling? These are all questions that the market has been asking for quite a while.
Do you see any change on that note? Do you see any change in the way South Africans are planning their production ahead? I mean, are they changing crop? Are they moving away from certain things and into new things? Okay, you mentioned yourself, your involvement in blueberries as one example, of course, but are there others?
Certainly organics is a... is on the rise, is growing. And the other big thing is chemical-free packaging. So you will find in almost every pack house, there are two separate packaging lines. One is known as the chem-free, and the other is where there has been sprays and chemicals used. And the volumes are starting to grow much bigger going through the chemical-free lines, and then also the organic products are definitely more and more in demand. More and more producers cannot afford to overlook it or look past it. They have to adapt and look towards organics. A component of their production must be organic production if they're going to stay in the game.
I would like actually to throw that on to Ruben as well, because Morocco and the northern part of Africa is of course very close, as I just mentioned earlier, and you mentioned, to a huge consumer market, giving the opportunity to grow and quickly supply organic produce with short transit times, relatively short transit times. Is that something that the Moroccans are paying for, building for, and get ready to supply more organic into Europe?
Of course, I mean, they have to grow their share of this as well. They may be a bit behind in terms of the experience on that, but there is a lot being invested in the field. And I think maybe one point that we also need to consider is the whole CO2 debate that is also still going on. What is the CO2 balance of something? There is no standard today as to measure for shipping. We have the discussion with containers. We have the discussion with others where there is at the moment no clear standard defined how to calculate it, but it's getting better, and you have some players like Beat Kuninaga and others that are really pushing this agenda with the customers. And once there is a standard and the consumer has a choice what kind of CO2 balance he wants to have on his product, it will become a factor. The younger generation has a very different attitude towards green than we have. And when you do, I still do a bit of teaching, and when you talk to students, they think very green. And I always call it the second green wave. The first was probably stopped after with the financial crisis, but the second one is there, and it will be a game changer for sure.
Do you calculate that, Fred, into your business, Greg, that some large consumer markets will be supplied more by trucks and short sea rather than containers and deep sea?
You know, we certainly try to go ahead and shifts in the market, and it's all tied back into equipment velocity, turn times, and average transit. So we do, you know, we do believe there's going to be some shifting, which is going to happen as markets develop and as we see some substitution markets. Others, right? So I think that's part of our forward-looking projections as well.
And again, to you, Ruben, a question from Alex from Temple. The issue about, you know, Morocco basically doing the same thing as Spain, and Spain running out of water, is a chance or possibility that Morocco runs out of water as well, irrigation.
Of course, at some stage, if your production gets too high, you will end up there as well. Huh? But they do things. The irrigation is partly based on desalination. It's in the areas which have the most rain. So, yeah, of course. I mean, water is a concern for everybody in a lot of areas in the world. Huh? This comes from climate change, and it will be an issue for everyone.
Yeah, for sure. What is the situation actually right now, Andy, in South Africa after several years of drought? What's the situation now?
In our production areas of the Eastern Cape, it is dams down below 8%. So that is really in desperate situation. The Eastern Cape, where a lot of the citrus is grown, and then up in the Avo and citrus production area of Tzanin, the dam is also very, very low. However, the rest of the country, the dams are all at 80% or 102%. The Western Cape had fantastic rains this year, but certainly in the citrus areas of Tzanin and Letsitheli, there's a lot of concern. And in the Eastern Cape, there's a lot of desperation over the water shortages there. Yeah. The husbandry has to be incredibly good to manage it.
Yeah. The expectation, of course, is that La Nina, the so-called opposite effect of the El Nino, is now providing a lot of rains in Australia. Fortunately for Australia, they've been lacking for many years, of course. So they should be filling up again, but it will for some way or another impact West Coast, South America, and Chile for a couple of years being hit by drought now. Obviously, time will tell, but let's see how that moves on. As a new estimate that just came out actually the day before yesterday. Alex is also asking, and this is probably a very open question to everyone, not meant for anyone in specific, but he refers also to the previous session where MSC participated. So the question is the following: is the drive for standardization, MSC collaboration, ACF and Rachel White, not a secret hankering for a full verticalization of the supply chain? In other words, export boards and just a few carriers. I mean, are we seeing, because of what is happening in South Africa, let's take that as another example, are we seeing the resurfacing of export boards and bigger units on one hand to manage export production and exports, and then on the other hand, driven maybe by, but also because of that, carriers are becoming fewer and larger? From a South African perspective, what is your viewpoint there?
I'm really not in a position of strength to comment on that. What we are seeing is a lot of the traditional insourcing, or the move to insourcing has stopped and is starting to reverse and go back fully towards outsourcing, and then the need to collaborate is certainly there. What we've seen in certain categories like citrus is globally they're looking at how to improve markets, but as far as shipping lines going, I'm not in a position to comment. We watch these mergers and these closures happening with quite a bit of consternation, and hope that the competition boards are watching as closely as we are.
You must have some viewpoints on this, Greg, because they are your customers, and in the past you have six or whatever the number is.
Yeah. Well, certainly over the years we've seen a lot of consolidation, and you know, it seems that the carriers have really leveraged scale, and hence the reason they have built very, very large ships over the last decade or two decades. So, but you know, what's interesting is I think that, and I can't speak for the lines directly, but I can speak to this in general. And I think that what maybe all of us are finding, and it's also the refrigerated trade, is, you know, the smaller vessels and niche carriers are actually more versatile in terms of trying to go ahead and provide better services to make sure they look at developing markets and niche markets. So on one sense, I think that the carriers have to look at their OPEX to make sure that that's competitive from a scale perspective. At the same time, I think what we're all learning is the vessel size versatility is becoming a more important play. And I think that may continue to drive some diversity in the marketplace. And again, I'm saying this not on behalf of the lines, but just from my observations.
As a former liner guy, I mean, I'm still, the consolidation is a fact of life and has happened also because of very bad incomes over a long period of time. Okay, we may not just look at two nice quarters now. We have to look at the 10 years before, which have been dire and which resulted in that. So we're living in a supply and demand situation. Of course, if there is money made in trade, new people will come up and will also have smaller services. This is a nice example. At the moment, we're talking about a Morocco to UK short haul service of 3 days transit time and things like that with smaller ships. Things are coming back up, and that's maybe also good. And we can also quickly bring in the conventional reefer side. I had discussions with a few of the conventional carriers in the last weeks, and they've been talked dead since 30 years, and they are still around, and some of them doing quite well at the moment in the current situation. So I wouldn't say the game is over yet. We are in a current situation based on the historic decisions, but what will come, we will see. And also the question, when we look at C-Cube, for example, is who will own the container in the future? The carriers didn't have money to invest in it. So we have a lot of leasing going on, and what will be the future of this? Will there be business models that operate differently where the container is not linked to the carrier anymore? Time will tell.
Well, we saw a situation here where our ports productivity went down to such a degree that we were lucky to have the specialized reefer vessels as a parachute. In a very good time, we were able to pull in vessels, and that just shows their versatility to meet the demand. We went from 147,650 pallets last year in conventional vessels to 198,000. Mm. You can do the math, but it's a growth in 30%. Mm. Was that a one-off? Well, it looks like it. I would say what it has done is given a new lease of life to the specialized reefer when you look at the South African context, because many exporters found it more reliable a way of getting door to door and getting fruit port to fruit port. And we still have three fruit ports in South Africa. So we could act with really fast agility and switch from 2.4 meter high pallets down to 2.1 meter high pallets and get the fruit into the market when we needed to, and bypass the state owned ports, which were crippled by their own problems. Yeah. So that gave the reefer vessel a really big boost of life here. And then more and more of them are a combination. They can carry, 100 plus containers, which is of huge benefit as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's a question here from Rachel and for the panel. We haven't touched much upon with the COVID-19 of the whole health security demands for safeguarding workers at either part of the chain and challenges of managing shifting workforce availability during the pandemic. Could the panel give their views, and particularly maybe Andy, from a grower origin point of view, and then if we get Juan Andres on later, then he can comment from a South American point of view. But over to you, Andy.
So from our point of view, the pandemic didn't actually only show that nursing staff are so valuable to a community. It showed our whole country how our farming community is so valuable to the South African gross domestic product. And it certainly did put a focus on the workforce. And largely, because of the seasonality of it, you have a migratory workforce that follows the production round and moves around quite a lot. And this is often handled by broker groups who specialize in those skill sets, those blue collar and semi-white collar skill sets, moving them around to where they needed. So we found that still our workforce is pretty stable. It's we've got a large supply of labor still. We don't have the problem that Europe has of getting enough hands to pick the product and to pack the product. And then we're also busy with a huge transformational program in South Africa where the recognition of females is as an equal to males, that old traditional legacy of they must be paid less is eroding away, and we're finding females doing more and more specialized work and skilled work in all sectors of our workforce. It is something that's improving. It's not a situation that we find is a big problem. Reliable labor season after season, yes, but that's minor compared to the rest of it.
Juan Andres, are you still with us?
Yes.
Do you have any have any views on this from a South American perspective? I mean, the whole safeguarding of the health of the workforce there. How did you manage in Chile or in Peru to actually, whilst the countries were totally closed down, how did you manage to keep them safe and sound and then keep working on?
Well, I think the food safety requirements of the majority of the perishable industry in Chile, mainly enforced by UK 20, 25 years ago with the exports of fruit, gave a good platform for all the players, or growers and packers, exporters, to work on the very control environment. And so COVID has taught us how good procedures work, really. When there is a good quality assurance system, actually things can work pretty good. And Andy was saying something very interesting about the workforce moving around. Chile used to be like that, but since October, when we have our social troubles, it's still on, but there was more problematic where activity was shut down pretty heavily. And then, of course, in March, when the country went into quarantine, there was a lot of workforce available. That never had, there was never before available for agriculture or perishables. It's just the way it was.
Okay, and we need to thank you for that, Juan Andres, and we need to close up because the session is closing down on us on 45 seconds. So thank you very much to the panel. Much enjoyed your input here. All the best to all of you. And I hand quickly back to Rachel, if you are still with us there.
I certainly am. I may go voice only if my webcam can't get up in time. Just wanted to thank the whole panel and thank you, Ole, very much for the fantastic moderation. Round of applause for you. Please come back and join us in the sessions again tomorrow. We have another full day continuing the themes. And we'll also be sharing information about our wrap-up martini event, virtual martini event tomorrow evening. We're hoping you can all join us for that. So have a great afternoon, evening, morning.